Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Sean Wildermuth, who is a Pluralsight author and has been a Microsoft MVP since 2002 and is generally recognized as one of the nicest guys in technology. Sean, how are you?
That is a shitty thing to say. Maybe I shouldn't use a profanity that quickly podcast. Into the
you
podcast.
Can, you can say anything you like, my friend. You know, I was going to start off by talking about your tour, and I want to do that. But what year did we meet?
Oh, wow. 97, I think? 96?
Okay, I've known you for too long.
Yes.
That's clear. So a couple things I want to talk to you about today, especially Angular 2. And if we have time, I'd like to talk to you about VR. And you also have been exploring ASP.NET Core. But before we get to any of that, you have been touring first the world and then the country with your Hello World road trip.
I have. Yeah, it was a fun but a busy trip. So when me and my wife got married a little over 2 years ago, we decided not to be adults, sell everything we own, and travel the world for a year. And that wasn't really part of the road trip, but we had planned on our way back home to remind people that I was still out there to do this trip of 17 cities in the U.S. to do nightly events and interview interesting people. We did that. It was a lot of fun, but instead of doing it at the end of the trip, I decided to break my shoulder and go home and heal for 6 months or 8 months or something.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then we started. We did the road trip in two blocks. We did the south and the west when the weather was bad, and then we came back and did a couple of dates in Europe, but mostly the east coast up through Canada and into the Midwest to sort of finish it up. And the goal there was to interview local people in each of the cities for the Hello World podcast that were, you know, sort of the local heroes of development in each city we were in. And so we had lined up a bunch of interesting people, you know, that were known, you know, nationally or locally, but to try to add some of the podcast recordings. Because one of the things that, you know, you've been doing this podcast for, you know, 4 million episodes or something so far. I don't remember what the number is. But I had gone to a podcast here in Atlanta by Jackie Cashin, who everyone should go listen to her podcast. It's called The Nerd Forest, which is perfect. And but the first time I heard a podcast live, I was like, wow, that's cool. You know, because we always think of it as, you know, two people in a basement or like this where we're over Skype and remote far reaches of the world. And that's something I wanted to bring to each of these cities. So we recorded episodes, you know, in each of the cities we stopped in.
That sounds great. And the Hello World, that's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The Hello World podcast. My brain is going really fast. Has been terrific because it's provided insights into how people got started and what they value in programming. And you've had some amazing people. And you had Scott Guthrie on.
We
and
did.
That was quite an interview as well.
Yeah, we recently released the Miguel Diaz-Caza chat as well.
Oh, that I have to listen to.
Which is very interesting because it's, you know, weeks after the Xamarin acquisition. So, you know, he was still getting comfortable being inside of Microsoft and, you know, being inside the thing he fought for a long time to make open source and suddenly is embracing open source. And I particularly like that episode.
Well, as a Xamarin programmer, I was very excited when Xamarin acquired Microsoft.
What's interesting is we had decided that for the Hello World podcast, that part of this process of doing the Hello World tour, road trip, was that we were going to stop at 100 episodes. You know, I had decided that, you know, there were only so many, you know, perfect stories to tell and we could go on forever, but I thought I'd stop at 100 episodes. And so the 100th episode is going to be me. And we actually recorded that on the road as well. We recorded in Vancouver with Richard Campbell interviewing me for a myriad of reasons I won't get into here. So early next year, when we finally get to 100 episodes, I'll finally get to tell my story.
Well, you couldn't have picked a better person to interview you.
Yeah, we were very lucky because our our guest accidentally dropped out in Vancouver, and Richard was the one who had suggested, well, if we can't find anyone, we'll just interview you. I was like, oh, that's perfect. Because we had actually planned on you interviewing me when we got to Boston. Mm-hmm. And then I had to, you know, grumble and come to you and say, do you mind? Because we can't find anyone who's in town in Vancouver.
And I lied and said it was fine.
You did lie, which I appreciate. That way I didn't have to feel bad about it.
All right, let me move you to technology, because that's why we're here. I said something to you about your incredibly successful course on Angular and 14 other technologies on Pluralsight.
Yes.
And that I was learning Angular 2, and you made a disparaging comment. So tell me why you prefer Angular 1 over Angular 2?
Well, I don't. I really like what Angular 2 is trying to do on the whole. I prefer to be working in TypeScript. I like the component model. There's a lot to like in Angular 2. But I'm finding myself struggling with fitting into their model. So here's the essential problem. Most of the Angular 2 stuff I've seen out there, the demos and in the examples and Deborah Carrata and John Papa both have really good Pluralsight courses on it that I went through to sort of get my head around it. And they seem to be, Angular 2 seems to be built perfectly to build single page applications. Great. Except that I'm opposed to that phrase single page application.
Okay.
Right? It just feels like we've taken the 1996 Visual Basic 6 monolithic client app and we've moved it to the web. And so the way I prefer to think about it is that we should be building these islands of functionality with these great client-side tools we have. Mm-hmm. So the pages that require a lot of interactivity are perfect for using Angular and even, you know, routing and things for complicated workflows. But your entire application shouldn't be one HTML page with a bunch of APIs behind it. There's cases where, you know, rendering on the server or having actual rendered HTML instead of using Angular makes sense. So that's been my stance for quite a while. The problem is that in order to use Angular really has this idea of, oh, we have one component that is going to take up some part of your page, and that you're not going to build up a bunch of things you're going to throw on pages. You're going to build up one giant thing you're going to put someplace, and really treating them all as separate applications, which makes it a little harder for shared code and the ceremony of doing this. So for each of the, I just rewrote the Atlanta Code Camp site using Angular 2 and ASP.NET Core and some other tech. And there's about six places where Angular makes a lot of sense. There's, you know, add your call for speakers and set up the administration pages and things like that. But most of it's, you know, showing who the speakers are and what their talks are and all that. And so I had to essentially build six of these Angular applications for those six places that made sense. But in each of those cases, I had to repeat this ceremony of making sure I have a Webpack script for it, making sure that I include the same set of components as the in the dependency injection sort of list of things that could be used over and over. I couldn't just have one app that had a bunch of directives that I could put on pages when I'm ready for them. And the actual programming day-to-day I really enjoyed. The ceremony of setting it all up I found painful.
What we'll have to do is get you to come back with John Papa and do a little back and forth on some of those issues and see what, you know, somebody who's been living and breathing Angular for a couple of years has to say.
Yeah, and he's been in it a lot longer than I. And so this is a huge possibility that I haven't had time to figure out, is I could be wrong. I've been planning to do this blog post so that people could go, no, you're missing the X, Y, and Z that makes all that easy.
Right.
But because I've sort of just trudged through, and because that's how I usually learn, as I build something and feel the pain or whatever, I might be missing something. And I'm super open to that being the possibility. Because I like I said, the actual programming model feels nice to me. I like the day-to-day sort of development. It's just the setup that makes me want to bang my head a little.
Well, you also mentioned really liking TypeScript. And my experience with TypeScript is that if you use Visual Studio, it does a lot of the setup for you. But if you try to use VS Code, especially not on a PC. There's an awful lot of setup that you have to do just to say to write your Hello World program.
Well, I don't have a Mac, so I haven't really had that experience. I've only done it in Visual Studio, and it that part isn't all that difficult. It was more the actually Angular setup piece than it is the TypeScript setup piece for me. It's the way you develop the main module and then pass every piece. I think that's you.
Yeah, it was. Sorry. Go ahead.
No problem.
Back from pass every piece.
Mm-hmm. And the sort of arcane way you have to use system config to tell it where modules are and how they're named. And there's just a lot of little pieces in making the loaders work in the way that makes sense to me. And even Webpack took me quite a while of setup to figure out how to, okay, they can build this all into one giant JavaScript for me, which is awesome. But the, you know, it may just be that I'm learning the tools and I'm not comfortable with them yet. That's why I'm sort of open to being wrong. I'm hoping, I'm going to be wrong in this, but we'll find out.
It's one of the great advantages of being on the bleeding edge with technology. And I mean, Angular 2 hasn't settled down yet either. We're still looking at a beta product, so.
Well, they say it's RC4, but they just pulled out components and pushed back in components. I think they took the Microsoft ASP.NET core strategy of naming releases.
Yes. I wonder if CLI is going to make some of that ceremony a lot easier.
It might. I haven't touched CLI because I sort of went through this CLI will make everything better thing with PhoneGap. And the problem with the CLI stuff is that it's hard to understand what all the generated code is doing. And my bread and butter, the thing that I care about is I want to know what's going on. I don't want to just trust that all the scaffolded stuff is just going to work, because ultimately I'm going to have to debug that at some point.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to switch topics on you. And you've been working in the VR AR space.
I don't know if working's the right name, but
playing.
A little of both. My wife, who officially she becomes the best wife ever. She bought me a HTC Vive for my birthday.
Wow.
After telling her she was asking like, why don't you have one of these things? I was like, because right now they're too expensive. It's crazy. $800 for a headset that you have to connect to a $2,000 computer seems like a little much. And she went, no, it's not. And so I'm going to force you to enjoy yourself, and I'm going to buy you one of these. And I have a Gear VR as well, which is the one you put your phone in. Mm-hmm. But that's like $100. That's, it's a piece of plastic and lenses that goes with a Samsung phone. When I started playing with the Vive, which I love, I started digging into the programming model. And I have a good friend, actually, we both have a good friend, Roger Peters, who's a super smart guy and has been into games for a long time. He's been trying to talk me into learning Unity for half a decade, maybe. I mean, it's just been crazy. He's like, really, you really should learn Unity. And that's not a very good impression of him, but
close enough.
And so when I got the Vive, I started to play around with it. I'm like, oh, this is actually cool. C#, and not having to do all the math of actually physics and having to draw figure out a lot of this stuff. I'm at the very beginnings of my learnings with it, but it's a cool tool set for developing 2D and 3D games, as far as I can tell. And because I started playing with this stuff, I got a notice that I had forgotten that I had signed up for the HoloLens preview, because an email was sent, and I was like, oh, I guess so. And I got an email saying that they were ready for me to buy one if I wanted to buy one. And I was like, $3,000 for a headset? I was complaining about the Vive's price.
I hope you said yes anyway.
I did.
Good for you.
At my wife's insisting. She's like, come on, the company's going to pay for it, right? Yeah, but that's not,
Right. So it's the left pocket instead of the right pocket, but what can I say?
Yeah, exactly. And so we got one, and I was kind of blown away by it. I mean, it being an early unit, it does have the problems people talk about with the keyhole problem of you know, you're not using your peripheral vision at all, so it sort of have to put your head around. But this idea of these objects in virtual in literal space is until you've played with one, it's hard to conceptualize. It's hard to explain to people sort of the magic there. And so I loaded up Unity, and there's a kit for the HoloLens, and this is a story I think explains everything about the HoloLens. So the first thing I did with the HoloLens was I tried to make a spinning teapot, because my experiences with 3D, you always start with a teapot for some reason. So I created a teapot, and it was spinning, and I put the HoloLens, installed the app, and I was like, I can see it, but it looks really far away. And I wasn't sure what I had done. What I had done was I'd put it too far into the depth. So it was farther away from me than I thought it was. At first, I thought I'd made it too small because there's no point of reference and you can't really tell. And so I got up off the couch so I could walk around it so I could see how small it was. And I realized it wasn't in my living room. And so I started following it, and it was on the porch. So the thing that I hadn't run into before the HoloLens is the HoloLens thinks about you as the center point of this infinite world. Whereas the Vive, you have sort of a 2 meter by 1 meter room to play in, or with the Oculus or the Gear, you're the you're looking around in three dimensions from where you are, but there's no real sense of knowing where a room is or whatever. And so those three experiences are very different. And I hadn't expected the HoloLens to be this, like, know how big my house is and be mapping all the walls so it knew the shapes of my rooms and where flat surfaces were to put things on. And it's pretty amazing tech, especially when you remember that it's just the headset. There isn't, like there is with the Vive, a 15-foot tether back to a computer or anything. It's an internet connection and a thing you put on your head and walk around anywhere.
Is it your sense that in a relatively short amount of time, this is going to go from super geeks to anything like mass market?
I don't know if they can bring it down in price or size enough quickly. That's the question. Because it's not heavy, but at the price point they have right now and the size, it's a little too geeky to walk around too long with.
Mm-hmm.
It also has the battery problem of an hour, hour and a half. You know, I see it more in corporate environments or industrial environments more than that, where, you know, they'll be able to contextually tell people to help them do their jobs better and things like that. So I don't know. I didn't think we'd be at this magical place of the dreams I had as a geeky 14-year-old are now real.
So yeah. How far are we from the obvious question? How far are we from HoloLens porn?
I don't know about HoloLens. I have heard, at least that's what I'm sticking to, that the other platforms already are crazy into porn.
Because that's what drove the adoption of the VCR.
It did. So I know that because I've been on Reddit before, that there's now a whole forum just for VR porn.
That's very bizarre.
That people were talking about. I was like, really? Wow.
Now, have you played with augmented reality as well?
Well, that's really what the HoloLens is. HoloLens is augmented reality in that, unlike the Vive or the Oculus or the Gear, which is VR and you're sort of isolated in a new world, the HoloLens, you can see your environment, and these things are placed in a semi-transparent or a semi-opaque, I'm not sure what the right word is, pieces in your world that know about your world. So it's a very different experience than what people think of. And I don't know how much of the HoloLens is applicable to sort of the hardcore gamer idea. There's an interesting Conquer game that is available for the HoloLens that you sort of use your head to walk this little character around your floor, and it knows that, oh, it can break a hole in walls and things will come out of it, and things that are pretty magical when you start to play with them. But I'm not sure how gamey it is. But I could imagine really easily Pokemon Go on a device like the HoloLens.
Mm-hmm. When I was traveling, what I really wanted was an app. Now, you're going to tell me that exists, but an app on my iPhone that you could point at a building and have it tell you what landmark that was and link into Wikipedia to tell you about it. That would have been fantastic.
And it is, there is an app for it, and there isn't one for the HoloLens, but I could imagine somebody building one pretty easily. The problem with like the travel-related ones is that so few travelers have internet access.
Yes.
Which you kind of need. It's not that you need to know where you are, but you need to sort of have the you know, pipe into the treasure or the treasure trove of all that data.
Right. So once we have Wi-Fi everywhere, then this will be a lot easier.
I think so. Or just cellular that's fast and worldwide instead of this, oh my God, I have to call AT&T to allow me to pay them too much money for 1 megabit, 1 megabyte at a time.
Yes. Okay. Let's get to the hardcore stuff. No pun intended.
Mm-hmm.
You have been, as I believe you said, you've been diving into ASP.NET Core.
Yeah, but I've been into ASP.NET Core pretty heavily for the last 6 or 8 months, something like that. So it's been kind of my focus. I obviously have the Pluralsight course that, you know, sort of the end-to-end that starts with ASP.NET Core but goes into Angular and such. And during the road trip, that was the second half of what we would do every night. We'd record a podcast, and then I'd do this sort of dog and pony show of writing an app from scratch to show people why ASP.NET Core exists. Not necessarily, you know, how every bit of it works, but why this is such a change to the platform. And that, to me, is sort of the compelling part.
What you just said may mean one of two things, which is, why did Microsoft make ASP.NET Core, or in what way is it such a change? And actually, those are two good questions, so I'll leave you to answer them both.
Well, I think they're really related, because ASP.NET Core, or ASP.NET MVC especially, has been sort of hamstrung since its creation in that it's on top of that same platform that they came up with in, you know, 2001. You know, a 15-year-old framework that said, we're going to live in IIS, we're going to live on top of whatever HTTP pipeline can be there. And they were always, you know, sort of held back because of, frankly, system.web. Web forms and system.web were keeping it from being fast, because everything in ASP.NET traditionally goes through these several layers before MVC could even be invoked, because they were laying on top of the, you know, of all this older code.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been this desire to sort of create something a little thinner, a little closer to the metal, so that they could achieve some of these much faster benchmarks, and so that websites weren't wasting their time before you actually got to your code. And so that process has been going on for a few years now. I remember seeing the first versions of this at an MVP summit probably 4 years ago. Project K, I think, is what it was called at the time. It isn't just about getting out from under all of that. It's about sort of thinking about the way web development is done here. And the best way I can explain that is something that I've talked about in a lot of these talks I've done. And that is, when 2003 or 2004 rolled around, Fritz Onion wrote this great book on ASP.NET. Most web developers on Microsoft at that point bought. We all read it, and it was really tried to explain how it actually worked. And one of the things in the book was the request pipeline. Here's all the places you can plug in code when you need to pre-authenticate, authorize, etc. Startup, shutdown. So anytime I needed to do anything more difficult than just write a controller and a view, I would go back to that several pages to understand the pipeline. And the reason that was always confusing was there's a lot of magic under the covers. ASP.NET originally was conceived with web forms as this idea of bringing desktop developers in. And so they tried to hide, in many ways, the way the web worked in order to get adoption, because then the hill wouldn't be nearly as high to climb for desktop developers to come to the web. And it worked. Millions and millions of sites are written that way. The problem is that in order to get down to the guts, it required really convoluted code. And some of that code ended up being slow. And so ASP.NET Core is as close to the metal as you can while maintaining the MVC Web API programming model. And so the skills you have for the 80% of the work you do, which is creating controllers and business logic and views, hasn't changed. But underneath that, you have this much more simplified opt-in model for starting up and configuring your website. And one of the things that's important there for me is in this method of the startup class called configure, you have the entire pipeline for your app. There's nothing hidden. Anything you need your app to do is in that configure class. So if you're curious about the order of operations for a request, you open up a file in your project and it's right there.
But what if you're not? What if you don't want to know that? What you want to do is focus on the front end. Can you ignore this change, or do you really need to understand this in order to be productive at all?
You don't. But my experience is that almost everyone has to dig down, because everyone has to deal with identities. Everyone has to deal with caching, with all these different things. So even though most of what we did was the front end sort of coding that we want to do, at some point being able to get down there, this is a lot more obvious about how to dig down, and I end up spending a lot less time fiddling and just being able to go, okay, I now need X, Y, or Z. I've done it. I can get back to the other work I want to do. So it frees me from worrying about the plumbing.
Yes. Okay. Can you put ASP.NET Core into context with regard to Roslyn and with regard to cross-platform development and all of these other changes that are going on around .NET development, especially web development?
Sure. I'm not really sure about how it's related to Roslyn. I'm sure it is in some respect. But the cross-platform is a big part of this as well, because one of the things that moving to ASP.NET Core allowed them to do was not have the dependency on Windows or IIS. Now, ASP.NET Core can still be hosted in IIS, on Windows, and on top of the traditional .NET framework, but they also can be hosted on top of .NET Core, which is the cross-platform version of the .NET framework. This means you can be in a Linux Docker container. You can be on running on your Mac. You can be running on Windows on Core as well. And to me, there's two pieces that make that Core interesting. One is obviously platform independence. So if I want to run on another operating system, especially for hosting, actually getting this, you know, exposed somewhere in the cloud, whether it's a Linux VM or a Docker image, I can certainly do that while still doing most of my development on Windows. But the piece that's really sexy, if any of this can be called sexy, is the idea of packaging my project. So one of the reasons Core is interesting is it can be it's just a set of assemblies, .NET Core, which means I can optionally not install it at the machine level. One of the problems with .NET framework traditionally has been, as patches and updates come in, we have to worry about every application it touches, because every application on a machine that you patch, you need to revalidate, and it becomes an IT nightmare and causes some of the friction between IT and development traditionally. In this case, for cases where it makes sense, you can actually package the entire .NET Core framework in with your app. So you have a folder with your entire application, including the entire .NET framework you need. You drop it on a Windows or a Linux box, and you run it. And that's it. It's entirely self-contained.
That is astounding. The name throws me a little. I know that I'm being picky, but the name ASP.NET Core implies that there's some part of ASP.NET that isn't core.
Sure, and I understand that. Originally it had been called ASP.NET 5, which I think arguably was more confusing.
Because it's so different?
Yeah, because it's not really the next version of ASP.NET 5. It is a new way of thinking about it. Because one of the changes that's happened with ASP.NET Core is that Microsoft, I believe, has looked out to the other ecosystems and tried to figure out what they're doing right and wrong. So they've embraced using open source tooling where they don't need to necessarily write the tooling. So Bower and NPM and JSPM are good examples of that. They've also said, let's try to learn in the ways that web developers are used to working. And so, less configuration and more convention. So you're going to see things like a special folder for any static assets like images and JavaScript files and CSS files, instead of having the special magic list of allowed files that could be served from the server. And a lot of these are ideas that are, sort of coming from outside of Microsoft. And I think this is all led by the fact that all of what we're talking about is open source, the tooling as well as the frameworks. And traditionally, when Microsoft's been involved in open source before now, it's been more about releasing their source code than it has been being open source. And I make the difference there is whether they're actually engaging with the open source community. And there are pull requests in ASP.NET Core, a lot of them, that were written by the community. They did a pull request on X, Y, or Z, and Microsoft said, yeah, that does fix something that we didn't realize, and it's part of the code base now.
How much of this do we get to attribute to Guthrie himself?
I think a big piece. So certainly there are people behind the scenes that I don't know their names that have been pushing this, but I give Guthrie a lot of credit for going, yes, we should, let's see if it works, which hadn't been the case with a lot of other people in those roles. I give Scott a huge amount of credit for if the ideas didn't come from him, and I don't know if they did, but I do know that he's the one who said, let's try it. And I think it's working way better than you could imagine. I mean, this really came down to when Xamarin was bought, one of the things they had to tell them was, well, if we purchase you, Xamarin has to become open source, which is ironic, you know, knowing where Miguel and the team came from. Oh, you have to release all of Xamarin's code open source just because that's what we're doing now? Yes. So, you know, I'm a big fan where it's going there. Because it is such a change, though, there isn't an easy migration path from ASP.NET 4 to ASP.NET Core. So I'm mostly telling people it's for Greenfield at the moment.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't see moving existing applications over to be, let alone easy, to be even particularly workable?
I think it is workable, but it's not a insignificant amount of work.
Okay.
A lot of the views will come over fine. A lot of the logic and controllers will come over fine, and everything else has to be changed. And so it's not, I want to dissuade people from thinking it's going to be, I'll open up my project in Core and it'll work. And we're just not there. We're quite a ways from being there because a lot of people rely on filters and other lower level mechanics that have changed completely. And so, you know, the top part of the UI work all is pretty much the same, but underneath that, everything is pretty dramatically different, just because it's clearer now than it was before. And so, changing a lot of that code isn't trivial.
You can imagine the meeting between the engineers and senior management when they said, well, in order to get these benefits, what we want to do is gut what exists in a way that will not be backwards compatible. Mm-hmm. That must have been a heck of a meeting.
Yeah. And they had to talk about, I think, the big benefits. One is cross-platform, and the other is we can finally break the ceiling of performance that we haven't been able to for a long, long time. They went from being, you know, many times slower than Node to a percentage point faster than Node now. And that's the huge payoff.